So when we talk about natives in publishing, you know, we've been, you know, publishing our work for a millennia.
I was originally pretty reticent about having a Lakota protagonist because I think that it's one of the tribes that Americans know the least about and know the most about from television.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Mandy Smoker Broaddus, who goes by the pen name M.L. Smoker, and Natalie Petersy, two poets who have recently collaborated on and published a graphic novel, Thunderous, the story of Ayana, a Lakota teenager trying to fit in with her high school peers, and in doing so, chooses to reject her indigenous heritage. When Ayana finds herself in a magic realm where her constant companion, her cell phone, is zero help, and she's pursued by the trickster Raven, she reaches out to a number of new friends and allies, whose care and vigilance makes her reconsider her priorities and the human and non-human beings with whom she nurtures kinship. M.L. Smoker belongs to the Assiniboine and Sioux tribes of the Fort Peck Reservation in northeastern Montana. Her current work focuses on the work of equity and inclusion for Native education in the Pacific Northwest. She is the author of the poetry collection, Another Attempt at Rescue, and she co-edited an anthology of poems titled I Go to the Ruined Place, Poems in Defense of Global Human Rights. Natalie Petersy is the author of the poetry chapbook, Black Birds, Blue Horse, an elegy, which won the Gold Lion Press Poetry Prize in 2011. A second poetry chapbook, Dreadful Luminosity, Letters, was published by Eduse Press in the spring of 2017. She lives in Helena, Montana, where she works on Open Country Press. Mandy, welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks for having us.
And Natalie, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Mandy, I'm going to start with you. What was the impetus for Thunderous? Why was this story one that you wanted to tell graphically, visually? Why a graphic novel?
Well, in children's literature, there's actually less than 1% that is written about and by Native Americans. So there is a huge hole and gap to fill in bringing contemporary Native stories to life. And so the story of Ayana is, you know, one that I think a lot of young people can relate to. Some of it harkens back to my own childhood experiences. And I just think that it gives all kids the opportunity to really see contemporary Native life.
You know, you said that less than 1% of children's literature speaks to or is written by Native authors. Is this something that is well known now in literature, or was that something that you were digging for a long time trying to come up with that statistic?
I found that research by listening to a presentation by a wonderful Native American woman who is a children's lit critic. And so she has done the really vast work of surveying sort of all children's Native literature. She has a wonderful blog. Her name is Debbie Reese. And so she's kind of the go-to person as far as Native children's literature. And that's a statistic that she had with quite a few others.
And Natalie, how did you come on board this project? How did this collaboration begin?
Well, Mandy was contacted by a contemporary of hers, Mato Standing High, who's Lakota, and some folks had asked him for some contacts for a writer who could get this children's book going, this graphic novel. And of course, Mato was like, I know the person. Got Mandy involved. And then Mandy asked me to join her, and I think if you knew Mandy better, you would know that no one says no to Mandy. So I hopped right in there. And We had some ideas right away. We do have children that are the same age. Our kids are both, well, my daughter's 10 and her son's 9. And we just had spent several years together during the pandemic in a germ group. And so we had some experience with kids' books with our kids. And we just spent so much time together that we thought it would be a good idea to work together.
Mandy, when this person reached out to you and said, I want a Indigenous children's or YA graphic novel written and made, were there criteria for it? Were there limitations on it? Or did you have free range for the story and the ideas that were going to go in it?
Well, we definitely collaborated with my colleague, Mato Standing High, as well as with the publishers that he was connected with. It was a very, collaborative sort of experience. Natalie and I, generated an outline with some ideas that we thought of right off the bat. I think the main sort of restriction in a process like this is we are, we're poets. We're accustomed to reading fiction and nonfiction. And there was a lot more to the story that we wanted to tell. There was a lot more narrative, other sort of facets and issues and topics to bring up. But within a graphic novel, you're very restricted as far as the page numbers, balancing out content with the art that's contained. And so those were all just sort of different issues that we had to sort of work through. But it went really well working with everyone.
Natalie, how do you see writing for the graphic novel being similar to writing poetry? Mandy sort of just spoke to kind of that process being sort of a constraint or like very different for you both just because you're poets and readers of maybe longer works. How are those things similar, poetry and writing towards a graphic novel?
Yeah, you want to say the most with the least amount of words. In the illustration process, whatever we came up with for dialogue literally gets handwritten into one of those little bubbles above the character's head or a thought bubble. And there's not much you can fit in that bubble, right? So what was amazing about this experience for me, what blew my mind, is the way the illustrator, Dale DeForest, took these tiny chunks of dialogue along with, we would have notes for the illustrator or how the arc of the storyline, what action was happening. And like he did so much with the illustrations that we could not do with language. It just blew my mind how he was able to do that. And it's not like he called us and he wasn't like, hey, I got to talk to you about this scene with the buffalo. Like, I'm not sure whether to do this or that. I mean, he just did it. And, yeah, it's amazing. It's like every poet's dream, I guess.
Mandy, do you have anything to add to that?
I think, I wanted to collaborate with Natalie on this, but for knowing how meaningful those small chunks of dialogue are in considering that they're, I wouldn't call it competing, but right, they're alongside these beautiful illustrations. And so, as she said, you only get a sparse amount of content. So you want to really, get it just right. And I think that's the same, trait that we carry into our poetry as we're editing and revising. We want every word to be in just the right place for just the right meaning. And so I definitely believe that we carried sort of that ability over into this as well.
Yeah, I really felt that the concision mirrored what it would be like to read a book of poetry. And another thing that I noticed too, there are pages where there are no text, there is no text, or panels where there is no text. And I found the lack of text, or what I will call silence in this context, so powerful. I think that's something that both poetry and this graphic novel in particular held together so well. The moments of silence where you can see something happening or something that's standing still, but it being powerful in that silence or that stillness. Natalie, I want to go back to the process of this collaboration. I'm wondering how long it took to write this graphic novel and what that actually looked like. Were you in the same space? Were you sending snippets back and forth? I'm wondering what those conversations were like.
Yeah, we spitballed a bunch of ideas, I guess, maybe a year ago. And then I think, and Mandy will correct me, we started hardcore getting it done last fall, September, October. And we had to have it completely finalized by January 1st. So we started hammering away at some big themes right away. We had a bunch of group conversations about what drama we wanted, what we talked at length, especially with Mato, about what was appropriate and what was authentic and what felt right for Ayana's journey. And once we got those big chunks of theme and content hammered out, then Mandy and I spent a lot of time on Google Docs, writing, rewriting. We would be in different places and have the document open, working on it live. We'd be on the phone. We would be sitting next to each other at someone's kitchen table. And then, you know, revise. We would change a few concepts, have to go back. You know, it's like a domino effect of, well, we changed this, so now we have to go back and change all this, making sure that we were tracking it all. And then at some point, I just like jumped on that document and wouldn't let anyone touch it. Because I was like, we're getting so close to this deadline. This is under lock and key now. I'm the guard. You might be able to have permission to change something if you're lucky. So, but if you, you know, poets, sometimes it takes like 4 years for a sequence of homes to be worth anything. So this was incredibly fast.
Writing this, you know, in this particular genre was very new to both of us. It, now that we've sort of experienced it, it all makes a lot of sense, sort of how things are sequenced and how it all comes together. So it was an incredibly quick turnaround time. But I think once we knew that, again, as Natalie said, those big themes, those big concepts that we wanted to include, you know, we were really able to spring from there and pull it all together.
I mean, it sounds like there is so much lacking in Indigenous literature or like representation in literature from Indigenous voices. I'm wondering how you pared down, you know, the concept, the overarching idea, because I think I would imagine that there's so much that you could have gone, so many directions you could have gone to, so much that you could have talked about that didn't make it into this final book. I guess my first question, Mandy, I'll point this to you, would be what that paring down process looked like, but also more broadly, you know, are you two going to be the authors of the entire series, or are there other authors taking up each different subsequent book? I'm curious about what the series will then look like.
There were two really important aspects that I brought up that we agreed upon very early. The first was and they're very large. So this is where it comes down to like, how do you sort of make this something meaningful and important? The first was just knowing the oral tradition of Indigenous people, you know, is so vast. So when we talk about natives and publishing, you know, we've been, you know, publishing our work for a millennia. And so, you know, we wanted to be mindful of the oral tradition and to be very respectful of just that as a thing itself. And then, you know, we thought one way that we could do that was to consider some potential Lakota narratives that, you know, have been used over time or have been, you know, used since time immemorial. And so once we were able to sort of narrow that in a little bit, that helped. And then the second really big piece we had to sort of work through was we really wanted to include to demonstrate traditional Lakota values through the narrative. And there are seven or more. And, you know, we sort of settled upon three for this particular story. And so that's to try and do more than that would have, you know, doubled the text in size. And so we wanted to be very meaningful and deliberate in those sorts of choices, so that young people didn't feel totally overwhelmed, you know, by all the information and all the new learning, but that it was meaningful still. As far as future texts, you know, I think as far as this particular media entity, you know, I think they do want to bring other voices from other tribes in particular, you know, to the page potentially. I think Natalie and I, you know, could hopefully and probably, you know, do at least, you know, another one or two for them in this particular series. But we'll see where that goes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with ML Smoker and Natalie Petersy. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Natalie, what kind of preparation did you have to do to write Thunderous? Mandy said that she did not have much experience with the graphic novel form. Were you already an avid reader of graphic novels, or did you have to kind of retrain your writer's brain to think within that paneled space?
I was not a fan of graphic novels. You know, I got into them because my daughter got into them. And she and I wrestled a bit over the pandemic over, you know, getting her reading done. She is a genius at avoiding work. It's remarkable the things that she can come up with to not sit down and do her timed reading. I've never seen anything like it. She will break out of any prison someone puts her in. And the thing that seemed to just sort of like make it better was having some graphic novels for her to read in between these big chapter books she was supposed to be tackling. And so I'd read them with her, and she just loved them. And I just started, you know, checking them out, thinking about it, and seeing what seemed cool and what didn't seem cool. I think the themes that are explored in Thunderous are specific to the Lakota people, and that's incredibly important, but also very relatable to my daughter and her peers. You know, gosh, that sense we have at that age that, you know, we just aren't sure, that self-assurance that we need, you know, is really important. And I noticed themes like that in the graphic novels that she was reading. So I just, that's all. And then, you know, then I just dove in.
Mandy, I'm going to ask you then the same questions. You know, were you a reader of graphic novels, and how did you go about, you know, training your brain to think in that space?
So one of my son's favorite graphic novels is The Crossover, which wasn't originally a graphic novel, but was put into that format for children that might appreciate it. And he really, really enjoyed that. We had also, you know, during the pandemic, you know, trying to stay on top of things, you know, and he has always been very interested in graphic novels. I will say, you know, both of our kids, you know, gave us very critical feedback at times about different ideas that we had or ways we thought the story could work. They were great as far as giving us a little bit of perspective from their age group, which is the intended age group for the book as well. So that was fun to sort of collaborate with them as well.
I love that so much. Yeah.
I do want to say something I think that's important is, you know, sharing with Natalie, and sort of engaging in this content together as, you know, she's non-native, but she was, you know, a really tremendous, you know, ally and has been. She, you know, did the work that she needed to do to read about, you know, more things and ask me and myself and Mato critical questions. And I just think that helped enrich the whole story overall as well, knowing we have native and non-native readers. You know, how are we making sure that our story, you know, really carries through for all audiences?
Yeah, not only native and non-native audiences, but also, you know, that age group and the older age group. Because, I mean, it was such a pleasure to read, even at my age, certainly not your children's age. So, yeah, I think that all that work certainly carried through. I'm wondering what those conversations looked like with your kids. What kind of comments and edits did they have for you? Natalie, do you remember that process at all?
Yeah, actually, Mandy's niece, Erica, was like, gosh, she's 18 now. It's so upsetting. But she was our first inspiration for Ayana. We actually sent the illustrator pictures of Erica. And I was just like glomming onto things that Erica used to like, right? Because she blew through this stuff and doesn't care about it anymore. But a while ago, you know, a couple summers ago, she was learning Korean. She was really into K-pop. And she would like write things in Korean in front of us and all kinds of things. And so immediately I was like, oh, we have to, you know, she's got to have a weird interest. You know, what about that K-pop thing with Erica? And the kids thought that was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard. They're like, oh my God, no. Oh. And then Desmond, Mandy said, it's like, Erica's not even into K-pop anymore. That was like 2 years ago. So, that'll keep you honest.
Well, I kind of want to take like a break and have you guys read. Will one of you contextualize this passage for listeners?
So at this point in the book, Ayana has made her way into sort of another realm, and she has encountered several new foes or friends along the way. She is traveling with a buffalo and trying to make her way towards someone who can potentially help her make her way back to her world, her version of Earth. And so as they are making this journey, they encounter a lost wolf pup and decide that they should help him locate his pack again.
Howl!
What was that?
A sad little howl.
Sounds like someone needs help. What's wrong, little guy?
I'm lost, and my pack is so far away, they can't hear my howl.
If we all howl together as loud as we can, I bet your pack will hear us. Ready?
Howl! Howl! That's them! Very brave of you to call a pack of wolves to your location.
I didn't think of that. Here you go.
Ina, did you hear me howl? Did you?
I did hear you, little one. Next time, do not wander so far.
Sorry, I was chasing after the prairie dogs because they were teasing me inside their holes.
We are grateful to you. No problem. I can't believe the whole pack came instead of just you.
Kinship is very important to wolves. We stick together. I'm sure you're just as tight with your own pack.
Yeah, it's important to stick together with family, isn't it?
Mandy, I'm wondering, how do you practice kinship? Or, Is practice even the right verb?
So one thing that I understand very rudimentary in a rudimentary way, because I'm still learning about, you know, those sorts of traditional values. You know, it was really about, it's about, you know, demonstrating those values in your daily life and in your daily practice and in your daily interactions with other people. And so it's not something, you know, that sort of sits off over here, you know, on a plaque on the wall as the way you're supposed to do things. And, you know, people don't necessarily sit down and say, this is kinship and this is what it means. And, you know, this is how you practice it. It's more that, you know, I think even traditionally young Lakota or other indigenous children would have observed, you know, the adults around them, the community around them, and how that community behaved, sort of meshed and made sure that everyone was taken care of and that everyone ultimately survived. And so, you know, it was by that sort of daily lived experience that you were able to sort of understand that, you know, to be in right relationship with yourself and with your community. And that, you know, you might not have said, oh, well, today I was a good relative, you know, or whatever, but your community would have, you know, expressed their gratitude or thanks if you had. So it just functions a little bit differently, I think.
Natalie, do you have anything that you would add about your own understanding of kinship?
Yeah, I think that going through this process, you know, I gained so much respect for Lakota culture and mythology. I think, no, I was originally pretty reticent about having a Lakota protagonist because I think that it is one of the tribes that Americans know the least about and know the most about from television and the BIA standoff and Dances with Wolves and all the good stuff. And, you know, that surface level knowledge, I think, can be really destructive. And so getting to know some of these, explore some of the Lakota values, you just sit there and think, man, we all have so much to learn about how to act from this. You know, this can only pay off if these kids read this and think about what it means, how we treat each other. And, you know, any parent is struggling to model that to their kids and build a community around them that functions in that way. And so, you know, I just had so much admiration for that and the way that some of those stories unfold and are so much more nuanced and less predictably plot-driven than maybe some of the stuff I grew up hearing.
Mandy and Natalie, thank you so much for joining me. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our sound engineer for this episode was Jake Birch. Our artwork was designed for The Right Question by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.